Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, it's your favorite Soul Sisters host, Jessie Katz and
Dara Golub.
And hi guys, good morning. don't know what time of day it is for you who are listening, but it's morning for us and we're sipping our coffee and waking up with y'all.
Thank you, Jess.
All right, what's today? Tuesday.
Tuesday. Feels like it could be any day, but it's does. Tuesday.
It's because we're locked in a control room right now and there's no light.
Yeah.
And I have no sense of
that's
the world.
Artificial light.
Yeah.
The weekend was so crazy also.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like still, I think, recovering from it in a way.
Uh-huh. You made some new fans of the band.
Did we?
Yeah. I brought some people out who had never seen you guys play before.
That was a fun, fun show.
Yeah.
I mean.
It was fun.
It was different.
It was very different. It was when I moved to Bushwick, I was shocked by how many adults were in Bushwick, which was not what I was expecting. But at that show, that was the Bushwick that I was anticipating, which
you said it,
dirty hipster
like
kids.
From Girls or something.
It was the Bushwick
just
from Girls. Like that party
like
that they went to.
Like a cliche of itself.
Right. Yeah. But, you
Shea
know.
Shea Stadium we're talking about.
Shea Stadium, which.
I had never been to.
You know. I know that the real Shea Stadium closed, and so I get why they felt like they were.
Field?
I get why they felt like they were allowed to call themselves that. But every person that I told that you were playing at Shea Stadium was like, "What?"
Yeah,
and then
too.
I had to explain it.
Everyone was like, "Congratulations!"
Yeah,
oh my
right.
God, that's
like
amazing.
You're the Beatles.
And which I have to be honest, like I did too when I first heard it. I was like, "What?" I mean, I didn't. I knew that there was something I was missing because I. but at the same time, I mean, I know that. Shea Stadium is no longer in that city field for
right.
one and for two
yeah, but
Pearl
you know,
Tricks are not going to be playing at a baseball stadium
yet
right now
but you know how your brain can like have
totally.
Two conflicting pieces of information and it just doesn't cross-reference
right you just don't take the time to be like hold on that
right.
doesn't add up right so people are like what.
But how many people does that venue actually hold? The
well,
new Shea Stadium.
The new, right. Well,
it felt
not
like 100 people.
It was not a baseball. Yeah, it was probably like, well, no, I think it was close to like 200 people.
Okay. I'm completely incapable of estimating anything spatial,
yeah.
So I figured I was off.
I think, yeah, I estimated about 150. I think it was more like 180. In a small.
It was packed.
It was packed.
The point is that it was packed. People were super stoked.
The show felt awesome because of it. It was great.
Good.
Yeah, good crowd. Good crowd for Not Blood Paint.
Yeah.
Oh my God, they're so wild.
They were intense.
Did you see the assassination attempt?
No. No, I started to feel too old to be standing in that room, and I went and hid on the balcony for a little bit.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
There was some nice fresh air right outside.
Uh-huh.
But Not Blood Paint is an extraordinary... four piece band, and they just put on every show that they perform a lot. Every single show has a different theatrical experience.
Okay. So it's a little bit performance art.
It's completely, I mean, it's like incredible, like music, metal and rock and all these different like glam rock and prog rock, like all these kind of different influences. And they wail. I mean, they're amazing musicians, But then they also add in this like completely dramatic element. And I didn't realize it was different every single time because it felt so extravagant, this sort of production that they put on with a king and queen sitting behind them on stage, literally in thrones with goblets of wine and face, like white face paint. And the whole, like everyone in the crowd had paper crowns and flowers that they would throw on stage.
And they shouted something about gender fluidity at the start of the set. Yeah. All my friends, I looked at each other like, yeah, Bushwick. It was so great.
Yeah. Yeah, Bushwick. Bushwick. It was great.
It was fun.
So that was fun. So that
I like embarrassed myself by fanning out too hard in the front row during your set.
Please don't ever say that. It's my favorite. Please.
Yeah, but I know that one song way too well because it's in
the new one.
Because it's in footage that you've given me of your rehearsal.
Cool.
So it's like I have my own private music video of it.
Adapter.
Yeah. But at the end, Lily like looked at me and pointed at me, and I was like, "Oh fuck."
What did you say? She's like, "You got it."
She gave me a little like, "Yeah, you know that song," and I just pointed back like, "Yep,
number one fan."
Yeah,
so good.
So it was fun.
So yeah, that was fun. That was Saturday. And then Sunday we had like the opposite show experience.
You played on Sunday?
We played on Sunday. Whoa. At a furniture store.
Okay.
Because this was for So Far Sounds. Have you heard of So Far Sounds?
Uh-uh.
It's this incredible thing that's been going on, I guess, since around 2009, where it's this like membership-based experience where you sign up and you get to go to these super intimate shows. So there must have been maybe like 60 people or something, all on couches and the beds and the furniture.
Where?
And just this like super stripped down. It was in Soho on Green Street.
Was it fun?
It was lovely. It was lovely. This is our second So Far Sounds. We played one in Dallas. And that one was kind of bigger and in a more sort of industrial space. And this was like literally like people sitting on beds and
Do you play
and
a full couches. Set?
Nope, we played about 4 or 5 songs or something. And it was super stripped down. Uh-huh. It was just bass and guitar and the ladies and it was
just acoustic?
Yeah, I mean, no, was it?
We were plugged in.
Yeah. But just way smaller and
that's awesome.
Yeah. It was so funny the difference. I mean, we're like in, you know, Soho in Manhattan.
Yeah.
The next day.
Yeah.
But no, it's really lovely.
But also So Far Sounds is weird really cool. And unique.
Yeah, exactly. So Far Sounds is a cool thing. Yeah. And I didn't realize how many they have in New York. Like they have them going on all the time, like several in a night. Wow. It's like volunteer based. And
I guess
it's
I'm
really
not
cool.
On that super cool mailing list because I am not getting these notifications.
Well, you have to like be interested. I mean, you see live music in other ways, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you have to like want to like go. And it's like mostly it's not big acts that come to like
right.
The biggest acts. So, but. Anyway,
cool.
It was fun. Yeah.
Like it.
Good weekend.
So so speaking of local New York indie bands, Charlene Kay is on the show today.
Charlene Kay. Homegirl.
Yeah. You know her from around town.
Yeah, it's funny. We know each other from New York friends, but we met in Savannah, Georgia, when we were both on tour there.
Uh-huh.
At a little cute festival. Savannah's the best. And she's the best. This is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good. And she's in the band San Fermin, I guess we should say.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellis, the songwriter mastermind, stopped by and joined her for a song at the end, which was amazing.
Beautiful.
Their stuff is very intense. And even just with the two of them, it was very intense to be in the room with that.
Yeah,
but
that was
in a really
cool to
good
see
way.
Just like just her voice. And then,
yeah, just her wailing.
Yeah.
And him playing along. All right. Well, then let's move along to our chat with Charlene Kay.
So this is exciting. This is the I've been waiting to do this interview with you. We almost did it.
She's been waiting for you.
I have. We almost did it. You had a show, which seemed like a really weird, random night with Yacht.
Yeah.
And it was like
Miss Mister,
and it was like in a space that I hadn't heard of before. Mm-hmm. And we tried to like set it up then, but
yeah,
I'm really looking forward to this because you're in my world. We're friends. We like know each other.
Yeah, we're basically friends.
We're basically right. That's right. That's where I get. We're basically friends. We're so close in almost being friends that we could just say that. So we met
maybe after today. Listen to the end, guys, and then we'll decide.
Official. Right. Yeah. So we met in Savannah.
That's right.
At the mm-hmm. Savannah Stopover Festival, yeah. A lovely little festival in a church.
Yep.
It was really nice.
What year was that?
I think that was 2015, I want to say.
In the summer or something.
Yeah. And then
And then, no, it must have been earlier than that, because then we did a show at South by Southwest for Hype Hotel.
Yes. And before that, I don't know if you were in the band at this point, but I saw you guys when you were Lily in the Parlor Tricks.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Back in, I think this must have been like 2012 or something,
yeah,
like that.
Okay.
It was like at the Knitting Factory. And it was part of, I want to say,
CBGB Fest?
It might have been that, or do you know Tinderbox Festival? It was like,
yeah,
a female-centric,
okay,
like festival lineup back then. And I was like, and it was so cool. And but I probably saw you then, even,
yes,
though I didn't know who you were.
Sure, yeah. But and that time you were doing your own thing. You weren't, mm-hmm, part of San Fermin yet,
yep,
at that point. But it wasn't until after we played shows together that I realized that you were already friends with all of my friends, and
yeah.
there was this connection. So it's interesting, you know, that you're kind of on this big national stage now, a national touring band, but also very much a part of a very local, mm-hmm, small knit community, which like intersects from different schools and, you know, cities around the country and all these different things. So it's cool to talk to you. And I'm just curious about if it feels that way, if you're like, you know, I'm part of this band, San Fermin, but that I come home and I have this family that I can collaborate with. And that, does that feel like an unusual thing, do you think, in the situation of being in a bigger band at this point?
Yeah, sometimes it's probably hard to go home.
You know, it's funny because I went to University of Michigan and I was an English major, but I was pretty 100% focused on music, even though
I'm from Columbus, Ohio. So.
Oh, nice. We can't be friends.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, it's okay. I don't really care about football. Yeah. And then I basically caravanned out to New York with a bunch of my musician friends after graduation.
Uh-huh.
We all got a practice space together. It was like this dank place in Chinatown with like mold on the walls and stuff like that. But we were committed. And since then, I've been here for almost 7 years now,
uh-huh,
which is pretty crazy to think about. I was actually in Prospect Park yesterday just reading a book, but like looking around at Brooklyn, where I first established my first home, like my first apartment when I moved to New York was in Brooklyn. And I have memories of Prospect Park as one of the first places in New York that I really identified with.
Mm-hmm.
And just I spent a lot of time in that park, like thinking about being a musician and, mm-hmm, what that would mean for my life and my career. And so coming, and I really haven't been back there for years because I since moved to Manhattan, and most of my recent memories revolve around Manhattan. So coming back to Brooklyn, I just reflected on everything that's happened since
I moved away.
And
which looks like what? What,
yeah,
are the bullet points in your mind,
right,
as,
oh,
you're,
man,
lying in the park?
Yeah.
Just a flash of tours and studios.
Yeah,
a little
bit. It's so, every single year is defined by different experiences, different tours and different people. And I've always wanted to do music as much as possible. And I think it was a real challenge for me to actually commit to making that my career by any means possible. And
is that from family upbringing, just your general nature? Like, what was that due to?
I think a lot of it had to do with family upbringing, to be honest. My parents were both grew up very poor and not in an artistic world at all. Like, both of my parents are from Singapore, and my mom grew up in a family of eight. And so she has six sisters and one brother.
Wow.
All the girls had to sleep in one room. The boy had to sleep and slept in his own room. And she always has just been very money conscious, for lack of a better term. And she's very worried about my being able to take care of myself with music, mm-hmm, understandably.
Sure.
And I often think like, wow, well, am I ever going to have health insurance? Am I ever going to have Social Security? Probably not. But I don't think about those things because I'm too busy doing what I really care about and what really energizes me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it took me a long time to actually commit to doing music and just trying to make it work. And I waited tables for a really long time when I first moved to the city,
uh-huh,
at a restaurant called Leal on Park Avenue, which is since, mm-hmm, I think last week just closed,
oh,
which blew my mind.
Yeah, they're like, that's
a
end of an era for New York
closing,
and for,
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, I think my mom definitely had a big impact on my decision to pursue this full time. I think if she had her druthers, she would have had me go to law school or,
yeah,
become,
yeah,
a doctor. Or it's I don't want to reinforce the like the Asian
stereotype,
stereotype, but actually I think it was based on financial stability, sure. First and foremost.
Of course.
It's scary. I mean, I had a similar experience where my parents were not unsupportive, but they said it would be great for you to go to like a liberal arts college and get an education that can, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, when you study English, when you study Spanish, it doesn't really, it's not like much more, you know, helping you get anywhere unless you want to be a teacher or whatever. but you know, it's an understandable thing as a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. So, I was talking to a friend this weekend who was telling me that she really worries now about retirement, saving for retirement, having a good job that will allow her to retire at a certain age. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was like, that's so funny because I am surrounded by creatives who aren't worrying about that because I guess the dream is that if you can make it in a creative field, you'll do that up until the day that you die. Like the idea of retirement
that's interesting
isn't
too.
A goal yeah. as much as if, you know, you have like the 9-to-5 that you're doing largely to pay the bills and you would like to be able to stop at some point so you can enjoy the rest of your life.
Right. The idea yeah. of stopping is not.
Right. Like what would that look like? Death.
Right. yeah. yeah. Right. Truly.
In a good way. Yeah.
So then you studied English, but you were in your mind, you were a musician.
Yeah.
You were always mm-hmm.
I was pretty much checked out as soon as I got there, which, you know, I don't want to demean the experience that I had at Michigan at all because it was a wonderful academic environment. And I learned so much that was not music related that I carry with me every single day. Mm-hmm. But it didn't take long for me to realize that I was very passionate about music and that was really the thing that I wanted to pursue after college.
Yeah. What were your instruments at that point? I know you're a guitar player now, mm-hmm. primarily as in addition to being a singer.
Yeah.
But that you also play lots of things.
Yeah, I actually started playing piano. That was my first instrument. And I played piano from when I was 6 to, like, studiously until I was about 16. And actually, when I was 14, I started listening to the radio. I started listening to a lot of pop punk and basically took my mom's nylon string acoustic guitar and taught myself Damn It by Blink-182. Nice. And then the rest was kind of history. It was so much easier for me to figure out chords and play songs that I knew and loved because uh-huh. I'm a horrible sight reader. And I think that was the big hindrance for me with classical piano is that it took me so long. And I think now it's a nice exercise to go back to those pieces and
yeah.
rediscover like what is so musical about them. But when you're 16, you're like, ah, I just want to play like punk music and
and you
cool.
could pick it out by ear.
yeah, yeah. So that was a lot easier for me back then.
Yeah.
Where were you living then?
In Arizona.
Okay. Did you have a band with friends in high school?
I had one band in high school. It was comprised of 3 guys from my Spanish class. We called ourselves Donald Truck Style. It was a totally nonsensical name. And we only played Weezer and Foo Fighters. That's my first band.
Which Weezer songs?
Say It Ain't So,
obviously.
Staple, uh-huh. Sweater Song.
Great.
Surf Wax America, mm-hmm. you name it.
Can we find classics. This on YouTube?
Unfortunately, no. We didn't have the means. I don't think anybody wants to see that, though.
I don't know about that.
Was there YouTube then?
There wasn't, but...
I don't think so. I think YouTube came around...
It was like
my
2005,
year
I think.
Of high school, exactly, which yeah. was 2005.
Mm-hmm. But someone might have taken video. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, that's
maybe,
true. Yeah.
Maybe retroactively. One of the guy's moms in secret. When we weren't looking.
Did you have Facebook then when you were in high school?
I remember making my Facebook page the first day of college.
Okay.
So yeah. I don't know if, I don't think there was Facebook.
It was 2004, I think, that it came out. So that would be your junior year, senior year high school.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I remember being on the track team and we were like doing our warm-up laps and some of my friends were like, yeah, in high school, in college, you don't need MySpace because you have Facebook. And everyone was on MySpace.
Well, when was MySpace in high school. Created? I don't even know.
I don't know.
Did you have
know.
A MySpace in high school?
I had 2 MySpaces in high school.
Oh, like a public and a
like
private?
Or like a Charlene and a band one?
Exactly. I had a personal one with like my zodiac sign and a blog. And then I had... And then I had my band page with like the music player.
Oh, right. MySpace
like
was not just about music. It was like Facebook.
Yeah.
It was like connect was the, and like yeah, meet yeah. people. Uh-huh, oh my God, uh-huh. I forgot that. Yeah. Just now.
Did so you guys weird. Have MySpace?
Yeah.
I did
so.
Not.
I still, like
you
my
were ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
They're just always behind it.
I think my music one is like still up. Like if you Google it, it's like there.
Oh my God.
Because you don't, I bet yours is like, I mean, unless you like take it down,
yeah.
those things like don't go
oh
away.
Oh my God. I had to,
it's weird.
I had to like exercise mine from the depths. I like went to support. I tried to like call somebody because it was horrible.
You tried to get rid of it.
Yeah. And I think it might still be there. It's just like,
if you went to a lot of trouble, I hope that you were successful, but just for the sake of like our internet, like peace of mind that you can succeed in getting things taken down.
I think this
down comes
up all the time where we're like, what is MySpace? And we never check. And like every episode this comes up and we're like, we don't know, as if we have no means of ever checking. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I know mine's there. I'm not saying.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
No, I know. Because there's also some music. Like you can't.
She's still updating it.
You can't
figure
right
out.
I'm like, check it every day. Yeah. Who's listening? No, because there's music that you can't like download or like do anything
yeah
with.
Yeah.
So it's like
once it's there.
Like, yeah, it's just like
they're holding
there
it hostage.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess yeah, and if you it was so big for like networking with other musicians too. It was like, what's your MySpace? And then
right
you would just
yeah
give them your MySpace. And I have to say I actually miss the platform of only having 4 songs available on your page.
That was the thing.
It kind of narrows down your choices to be like, okay, if I want to discover a band, what do they think I should listen to?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really cool way for me to discover music because you didn't have to dig through a bunch of
right. So now it's like there's just too much. Yeah.
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 So
did you guys
it back
either of you ever like walk around with demo tapes or CDs or anything?
I feel like it was past CD time. It was yeah like mm-hmm iPod.
Right.
Yeah. The iPod was.
But what if you just met someone in a bar and you wanted to be like, yeah, listen to us.
I think I'm recommending you
should start doing
this. The only time I've ever done that was, I think I was in 10th grade and I made a burned CD of covers that I had made with like the shitty voice recorder app on my mom's PC. And it was covers of like Michelle Branch and nice. Who else was it? It was like
Victor, what was her name? Vanessa Whiteside.
Oh, Vanessa Carlton?
Who's Vanessa White? She's like a friend. That's a friend of mine. No, Vanessa Carlton.
Yes. Stuff like, it was in that realm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I took a picture of myself in my bathtub because it had like a white background. And I put my camera on
selfie.
On self. Yeah, this was like one of the
wow
first stuff.
Wow,
yeah.
How provocative.
It was, yeah. It was like the, you know, the downward
yeah,
MySpace
yeah
angle. No, it was like, it was just because I had a white background and I had my guitar in the bathtub, like looking passionately disinterested. And I printed it out and like pasted it onto the blank CD.
Nice.
And then I gave it to my classmates at school.
Nice. There you go.
That was my
so
hustling.
You did it.
That was
attempt. Not afraid
hustle
of the hustle.
Yeah.
Not afraid of the self
small sphere, but you still
yeah
did
yeah
it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You never know. Your classmates could have a parent who's a record executive and they
yeah
accidentally put it on in the car.
And
there you
another
go.
Another 16-year-old girl yeah singing Michelle Branch.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly what we need.
And I wonder when GarageBand, because mm that changed everything too, because that allowed
yeah
you to not just like,
yeah
like record something with what? With, you know, like a tape recorder or,
yep
or something.
Well, that was probably some iteration of the Mac that mm-hmm came installed with that.
Yeah. Do you remember, like, yeah so did that start happening in high school using that software?
I will tell you, I bought a Mac because of GarageBand. I went into the store and the only concept of multi-tracking that I had known up until that point was taking the same voice memo app on my mom's PC that I was telling you about. And recording the 3 separate harmonies from my choir class. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can hear myself at this like 3 times. But the problem was that every time you wanted to harmonize with yourself, you'd have to open a separate window with a separate record button to record the previous thing
mm-hmm
with the one that you were currently singing. And
right
each time the quality of the previous harmony mm would degrade just a little bit.
Right.
But with GarageBand, you could actually like make multiple tracks and you could have drum loops and it was the most magical thing
yeah
for me.
Yeah.
So that was a huge game changer.
Totally. So when was that? That was like your junior year or something?
Let's see. That must have been, I think that was 2001 or 2002.
Okay.
So I think I was 16.
Okay.
Sophomore
so you're probably like, man, I know I love this, but I'm going to go to college.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to learn lots of things
uh-huh
and do music all the time.
Yeah, it was basically a much more like uninformed version of what I currently do now on Logic.
So there's no formal music studying in college.
I took a couple voice lessons from a couple instructors, but I didn't study regularly with them. It was more
yeah
out of the curiosity of like, what is this like? I've never taken a voice lesson before. But besides that, I didn't continue piano lessons into college. And it was more about, self-exploration. It was more about going out to meet people, going to open mics, going to as many shows as possible, and just kind of discovering like how many different kinds of music and musicians there were.
Is there a good music scene there? I mean, there must be. It's such a huge school.
When I was there, it was popping. It was really a rich time for independent musicians to thrive in Ann Arbor and Detroit. And this club called The Blind Pig had a great roster of acts always coming
through.
That's
just where we went.
That's so cool. I love that place. Apparently Nirvana played there back in the 90s.
Oh man.
And they're so proud of it.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it was really great. This Chris Bathgate, who's a folk singer songwriter, comes out of there, and Electric Six, who you just went on tour with.
Yeah.
Is from Detroit. Alex Winston, also from Detroit.
Right, exactly.
And I'm trying to think of other...
Flint Eastwood, who we just played with again, also from Detroit.
Yeah.
So many... it's a lot of good acts.
Yeah, yeah. It's... I'm not sure what the scene is like now, but back then it was awesome. And I feel like a lot of people that were just kind of burgeoning at the time are now like full-time touring musicians that are...
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if that scene took a hit in Detroit recently, it's probably coming back again already because a lot of artists are moving into Detroit now, I think, because it's affordable and they're trying to build it back up in that way.
Yeah, I think it's on the upswing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For that, at least.
Right. So, cool. So then... The scene, like a lot of what I've seen about the connections that you've made since started then. Like talk about, what was it called? The internet star kids? What was it?
Some combination of those words?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk about the scene that you got involved with, because it seemed like an actual like group of people who were doing something very different and using the internet in a way that was new at that time, kind of.
Oh, yeah, totally. So,
was this still in Michigan?
This is in Michigan. My last year at Michigan, a bunch of my friends in the theater department put on a 3-hour parody musical of that, which was basically a condensed plot of all 7 of the Harry Potter books in 1 3-hour musical. And it was brilliant. It was so funny. And
are you a Harry Potter fan?
I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. Yeah. And it was profane and like just like explicitly said all the subtext between characters that everyone's thinking the whole time. Do you guys read Harry Potter?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
I hear.
I missed it a little bit.
I totally missed that train.
Yeah. It's not too late.
No.
But one of the, so the guy that played Harry is my friend Darren Criss, who went to Michigan and went on to play Blaine in the show Glee. And so, unrelated to that though, StarKid put this, they started a theater group and called themselves StarKid. So they put this musical up online, and within a week it had something like 2 million views or something like that. And it just totally tapped into all of the corners of the internet that were specific to that intersection of musical theater nerd and Harry Potter nerd. And it just exploded.
Wow.
And suddenly they had like 100,000 followers on Twitter. Like their Facebook presence became massive. And it was just this complete phenomenon that everyone was completely surprised by.
Crazy. Do you know if there was one thing that pushed it through to like get it sort of have that visibility? Or was it just like people are searching for like Harry Potter? And
well, those fan sites like MuggleNet and Leaky Cauldron, it's not like I know all of them by heart. Like they posted about it, and then honestly it's just word of mouth because these people have like fan communities that they tell their friends Harry Potter related content that pops up, and this was like
so
kryptonite
unique
for them.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I think it was primarily word of mouth that this thing got spread around the internet as quickly as it did. And then after that, they used that platform to create more original musicals, that many of which were parodies, but some of which were originals. And Darren helped write a lot of the music for it. It was like a collaborative effort from everyone that was involved in the original musical and then the subsequent musicals. And then they decided to go on tour with the catalog of music that they had developed since the very first Potter musical. And so this was like 3 years later. And I think at this point they had like 6 musicals or something like that.
Yeah.
So they had a lot under their belt.
Yeah. There's like funny names. I thought I wrote one down, but like the second one, it's like, I don't know what it was.
Is it Me and My Dick?
Yeah.
Okay. That one is incredible. It's really goofy because of the name, but it is basically like a walking penis and a walking vagina of these two high school kids. And they're the two kids, and then they dress their alter egos, their ids, for lack of a better term, up as their genitalia, and they have a conversation and they flirt with people and they have side conversations. And it's actually a very accurate reflection of what your brain is and your hormones are battling in high school.
Man. Oh, costumes? Was it like representational? Oh, yeah. Like,
oh, completely. It was my friend Joe, he's hysterical. He plays the penis and he has a fleshy costume with two balloons on each of his ankles. It's so funny.
So yeah, that's going to go viral.
Uh-huh.
So they're taking these on the road.
Yeah. And so in 2011, they went on their first tour called the Space Tour and invited me to play guitar in their backing band and open for them.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
And so
it just as a solo act.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was able to bring a band, but yeah, it was my solo project.
Okay.
And it was the first time that they had actually interacted with the fan base that had otherwise existed purely online.
Uh-huh.
And so we got to see in person what this movement was. And it was slightly, it was amazing. And it was terrifying.
Yeah.
Because they're just diehard StarKid fans, like One Direction, Justin Bieber level.
Wow.
Devotion to this
what
movement.
Age?
Primarily teenage girls.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say like...
It's always teenage girls.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. What kind of venues were you playing in?
I would say that probably the average size of the venue was like 2,000 people. And
wow.
We played Roseland in New York before
really?
It closed down. Yeah.
It's legit.
Yeah. So this got really real. Cool. I mean, was there backing for this at some point? Was there like sort of a team behind?
They didn't have a label, if
okay.
that's what you mean.
Or,
but
yeah, I don't know what a musical theater internet like thing, like this is such a hybrid of a thing. I don't know what
I
it
know.
Would have been, you know,
mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
just management or.
Yeah. I think honestly, they funded a lot of it through merch.
Okay.
And fans from the websites that just wanted them to come to their cities, and so they would support them in any way they could. They sold the soundtracks to all of their musicals, stuff like that, and you really got to see the people. We joke that StarKid is like one big inside joke.
Yeah.
If you've never heard of it, you've no idea what it is. But if you're in on it, then you think it's the funniest thing in the whole world.
Right.
And so the shows were really, it was like a digital tour in the sense that you're finally seeing up close and personal the people that you've only seen intimately on your own on a TV screen.
Well, right. I mean, it's so, like any, like it's, you want to take it to like the Glee level. It's like, uh-huh, you're like, they go on tour and then you get to interact and see the people that you're watching on television. But here it's like a more intimate thing that feels personal because it's like, you're doing Harry Potter in a musical and now you're here performing it for me. Like, this is a private, yeah. I feel like this is like an inside.
Yeah. It's a private show for 3,000 fans.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so sad. Exactly. The thing that I connect to in my head, I'm like, oh, it's like Sesame Street Live.
Right.
No, I remember seeing thing. That when I was a like, kid. That was like the coolest thing ever.
Frozen on Ice.
Yeah.
No. I mean, getting to like see the people that you watch then perform live. It's a cool thing. Like on TV or on film or something.
Right. So had you graduated at that point?
Yeah.
This is after graduation.
Mm-hmm. I was 2 years out of college at that point.
Okay.
Were you never a musical theater nerd to like want to be in the shows?
No, I'm not an actress by any means.
Yet.
I actually just took an improv class in January. Voila. My first ever foray into that.
Where?
At UCB.
Yeah. How'd it go?
I loved it. I loved it. It's so fun. And I love comedy, but I just never have considered myself the vessel for that art form.
What prompted you taking the class?
I just love comedy. I listen to comedy podcasts. I go see improv. And I felt like it would make me a better performer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just in terms of being able to think on your toes.
Yeah, it bleeds into other stuff.
Yeah. Right.
How was your graduation show?
It was fine.
Yeah. It can be a little touch and go.
Didn't green at the wheel or anything, but we'll see how that changes.
Are you going to do another level?
I'd love to, but at this point, I'm not going to be in town for 8 consecutive weeks anytime soon.
Yeah, it's a commitment.
So.
It's a commitment. Yeah. I think there are like intensive ones you can take where they cram it into I don't know, a month or something.
Yeah.
It's like they, 8 hours.
They have like week long ones where you do it like 10 hours a day. I don't think I'm cut out for that.
I mean, it's funny, like, depending on what you are inclined to do, like, you know, getting on stage and performing music could seem intimidating to people, but doing comedy is the most intimidating thing I find. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not, I feel like you'd be great at improv.
No. but I feel like they are the same in that you kind of have to have it to do it. I mean, you can study, but you have to have an innate talent. You can't, right?
I don't know. I mean, I think that you have to, for comedy, you have to have something very different than you have to have for music, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just so ballsy.
Like you either got it or you don't.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about improv that's great though, is that when, at least my teacher encouraged us not to be funny. And that put a lot, that took
a lot of pressure.
Of pressure off of you, because mostly it's just reacting honestly to what a situation is and trying to add how you would normally react, which sounds really counterintuitive to a performance that is supposed to make people laugh, but somehow it works. And
I mean, but that's layered. It's like, don't try to be funny, but be as natural as you can so that it's then the funniest thing in the world. I mean, the end game is still to be really funny.
Uh-huh. You just can't be conscious of it. And there are certainly rules as you advance the levels and stuff like that.
Oh, but the Herald?
Oh,
did you guys get into that?
Not yet.
Okay.
I think the 201 is where you really explore like the long form game and learn more of the structure of it. But
that's the craziest thing, that you have to be so in the moment that you're just purely reacting to someone on stage, but also another part of your brain has to be tracking what's going on so that you can keep coming back.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And thinking, it's so always thinking like 3 steps ahead.
But being as present as a human can be at the same time.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it is that it's not, so much of it is, it just teaches you to be adaptable. That's all it is. It's
like totally
somebody says something, you have no idea what they're going to say. It's whatever that is, you have to commit to it and make whatever.
Not to be afraid.
You can't have any preconceived notions of what you wanted the scene to be. It's just kind of have to roll with it.
I mean, you guys have to deal with that on stage all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like some shit happens and you're like, fuck. But can't keep going.
From the, I guess, I don't know if this is a musical theater thing or it's like I have it in me to just like, you don't even for a second like let on in your face that anything happened. That's the move. Like if like something happens, like there are some people who will be like, oh, fuck, you know, that happened and like really make a thing of it. And I just like, and I don't know if, I don't know which is better in like a sort of, in the different.
Yeah.
Different
well, most context, of the time it's something different. The audience probably wouldn't even know, right?
Yeah.
Like there's probably a lot of stuff that happens where you guys are like, shit, but we have no clue.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And if you just carry on, we would never know the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the, also do you, in shows that you do you have to sort of do like banter and like talk to the audience? That's the stuff.
We try to choreograph it so that we don't step on each other's toes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we don't, we, it's not like a stand-up show, but I guess like, I guess our last show in Baltimore, our drummer broke his snare drum. And so there are a few moments where we were like, okay, what do we do? Time. Anyone have any jokes? But well, it turned out okay. And it's those moments where, yeah, exactly. You just have to be adaptable and just.
That's funny how that can be more stressful than like the anything.
Yeah.
Like dead time.
On Nerdist, Chris Hardwick always talks about how he heard the story that when Prince plays a wrong note, mm-hmm. he'll then play it again.
Oh my gosh.
So that it sounds super intentional.
That sounds like our trumpet player.
Yeah.
Just unapologetic.
Yeah.
So you're now, you're traveling around with this, with still on StarKid. So you're going around with them mm-hmm. doing the shows.
Yes.
Playing guitar, playing your own original music?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And which you had written during college or after or just like throughout your life?
At that point, it was 2011. I was out of college for 2 years. And so I had written my second album. And it was so fortuitous that it came out right as the second StarKid tour was beginning. And so I was able to tour on that album with StarKid, which was amazing. And and so that was a 4-week tour around America. And that was actually the last one they've done. They haven't toured since
2011.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What happened?
I'm sorry, 2012. That was the second one. They're just doing other
things.
Projects. Yeah, they're doing a musical now based on a caveman, and that'll be out this summer. And yeah, they're just always working on new stuff.
Cool. So at that time when you were playing on your second album, so what happened with the first album?
So I released the first album when I was in college. And that was totally just my first foray into recording. And I recorded it with a good friend of mine, Jim Roll, at his home studio in Ann Arbor. And that came out when I was a junior.
Okay. So you put that out just on your own, on iTunes?
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. And then wrote a second one, played mm-hmm. on it. And then, so now you have this 2 albums worth of music. Mm-hmm. Are you then saying to yourself, let me be touring on this? And like, what is your thought process as far as going forward?
Right now or back then?
Then.
So after my second album came out and I had toured with StarKid, I reached a point where I felt very lost and I didn't know exactly what the next step was going to be. I thought for a minute that I would not do music anymore. I was exploring different career opportunities. I took a web design course, got really interested in that, thinking that that might be an alternative career path.
What was making you feel this way?
I think it was a lack of confidence. There were a few, it was a sad year. There were a lot of life events that happened that kind of compounded into like my having the lowest self-esteem that I'd had for a long time and not really believing in myself anymore. I just didn't feel inspired mm-hmm. for whatever mm-hmm. reason. And the stuff that I wrote just wasn't really ringing true to me. Mm-hmm. And I think I was trying to create without really having it come from like a real place. Like I think I just was very eager to race ahead into the next era, whatever that was, but not really doing like the personal work to make it feel authentic.
Mm-hmm. So was that after Animal Love or before?
This is after Animal
okay.
Love.
Mm-hmm. So even after that whole project, which has beautiful, wonderful videos and beautiful music, and you did a lot or surrounding that project. I mean, there's a lot of mm-hmm. good stuff there that seems like I would have thought that project felt good, mm-hmm. good, and that you would have felt good after. And it seems like you had a lot of fans who were supportive at that time, which is fantastic when you're just like a solo artist and you don't have, you know, you have support. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm.
Well, that's
interesting.
I think every artist goes through this once they've completed an album cycle. Mm. You can either be like, okay, what's next? I'm just going to like do whatever's next. Or you can get overwhelmed with the expectations that you have of yourself and slide into self-doubt and depression, which I learned the hard way is really easy to do. And when you're, when you have a career that depends entirely on your own drive and your own, like you have to be almost in this like constant state of, self-analysis, and you're almost, it almost feels like you have to write a thesis on your life like every few years. And I didn't necessarily want to write about the events in my personal life that were going on, and I didn't feel comfortable writing about that honestly for whatever reason, and that really messed with my mind creatively.
Yeah, it's a bummer. Yeah.
So I just decided to take a step back, like not put any pressure on myself to create anything that didn't feel honest to me. And then actually at that moment, San Fermín came along.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. So
the universe.
Yeah. Really? So you stepped back. Were you working like a day job and just, you went to, you studied design and...
Yeah, I was doing web design and I was teaching and just kind of going through the motions, like not feeling super fulfilled.
Where were you teaching? What were you teaching?
I taught private lessons, guitar, songwriting, and piano.
Cool.
Yeah. And then...
Do you enjoy that or is that kind of like a...
I actually really do enjoy that. It's really fun to help somebody else along their musical journey. And I think that was healing for me too, to just step outside of myself and see where other people were at.
Yeah, nice. So, and before San Francisco, so this is like 2013, 2012, 2013?
Okay. Yeah, 2013 was the apocalyptic year that it seems like a lot of my friends just had a really hard time that year too.
Yeah.
There's something about that year.
So have you been connected with all of the people that we started talking about before we started recording the podcast? So we have all of these friends in common. How did that connect? Like, how did you meet Sarah and, you know, Bruno and all of the people that we sort of, that are in this New York scene that we're both part of?
Yeah. So Sarah has played keyboards with me in my own musical band, in my own band. Bruno's played drums with me. They're both mutual friends of mine and Dara's. I guess I just met them through seeing them play with other people. And I just admired them from afar. And then I scooped them up as friends.
That's how you basically, you were like just being a sort of friendly, you know, fellow musician and,
I guess
meeting
so.
People.
I think, I can't remember who I saw. Oh, I saw Sarah play with Rocket and the Ghost.
Okay.
And I was like, you're such a badass.
So
I met up with her. I just kept seeing her places and I was like, we need to be friends. So
That's awesome.
We hung out that way.
Awesome.
And what's then her last name?
Sarah Goldstone. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
Badass keyboard player and
what
singer.
Up, Sarah?
Yeah.
How would you guys describe the music scene in New York that you're referring to? What is your scene that you guys share?
Well, you used the word incestuous earlier and it really, that's,
but I mean, like, in terms of the music.
Oh.
we'll get into that next. Let's start big and then let's zoom in on that.
All right.
All over
just
the place.
Like indie,
everything.
Indie music.
Indie.
Scene?
Well, yeah, I think that's the word, the difference, I guess, between how I started to say, like, being in part of San Fermín versus coming back to New York and being part of, you know, Rockin' the Ghost and Parlor Tricks and all. And what's the Knicks band?
Twin Wave.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many of these bands that we're all parts of and interchangeable with that are doing different genres, but all sort of indie and, you know, indie with some electro, synthy, you know, there's a lot of that.
But
it's like, what?
No, it's like I was telling someone this weekend, like, I'm like much more plugged into the music scene in New York than I was before because of my friend. And they were like, what scene is that? And then I just like went blank. I was like, I don't know.
I think the one that we're referring to is like indie rock, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
like, playing all of the rock clubs in New York.
Right.
And
yeah. Cause I guess there's just a handful, really. It's not so many venues.
Well, not anymore. Yeah. They're all closed.
Right. They're all closed. And then smaller ones are. Yeah. Yeah.
So does it feel like a small town for you guys in that way?
Yeah.
Like it's weird because people consider New York to be one of the meccas of music in the entire world. And when you consider how many people move to New York to try to make it in music, then it would make it seem like that world would be huge. But I guess it breaks down as being actually a very small community. Agreed?
Yeah.
Agree?
I would say so.
Yeah. I think it becomes smaller. Like if you're part of it for a while, then it becomes smaller because everyone does end up sort of playing the degrees of separation between you and another person become like,
right.
mm-hmm. you know, decrease all the time. And so it's still huge. I mean, so I feel like you have brought a sort of little mini like Michigan, like cadre to it. Like, so like you have some Michigan people and like, I come with like New School people and then like Sarah and like Marilee and people are like Berkeley people or, you know, and just like you, there are these little pockets of groups that then connect.
Yeah.
And then now you have a bigger scene and it's sort of,
but then does that ever become a barrier or, are rivalries ever born out of that? Like, well, we come from this background and we have this in common. No,
I don't think there's like a Jets and Sharks mentality.
I think it's like a very supportive, like collaborative community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I would say.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's gotta go the other way sometimes. I mean, for any group of people that you're all trying to achieve the same thing and people rise and fall, sometimes it's gotta get a little dicey, no? Or it's really just that supportive.
I mean,
all the time.
I just think that there's enough room for everybody that there's not that like, well, if you get this gig, there I'm not going to get that gig. You know, there's not. It's not that situation so much. I think there's like just so much to go around.
Yeah,
so much playing, so much opportunity.
And so is it very different then from like the film and TV world, for example?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
Because I guess. Well, like if you're an actor, you're auditioning against all these other people. There are only so many roles. And so you're like constantly fighting mm-hmm. for a thing and constantly being rejected and other people are being rewarded. And,
right. Here yeah. you're making your own stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's different, you know, if you're a sort of musician who gets hired to be in bands and then it's different than having your own project or being part of one full time. But even then, I think that there's enough stuff happening that it's not that same level of competition or
yeah.
that vibe.
Even if someone makes an album that blows up.
I think people are just happy about it.
Well, you guys what are so nice.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm overstating the sort of supportiveness.
I guess I just don't. Yeah, I'm not a terribly competitive musician. So I might be less tuned into that
yeah.
energy, possibly.
Yeah.
That's good.
And it's nice to like seek out to say, oh, like, you're a badass. I'm going to meet you and like, we're just going to connect. And that's,
yeah.
So that
I guess there's always going to be petty shit talkers and they probably attract each other and it stays amongst
right.
them.
Yeah.
And you guys yeah. are not interested. So it's not coming world. To you.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah, for sure.
And you don't play with people like that probably because it's not attractive to you.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
So then Stand For Me and how does that go down? Who, how, what was the story there?
So I had met this woman, Joy, who was a super talented keyboard player and singer at what's called the Seven Train Sessions. It's like a house show up in Queens that my friend James puts together. And I'd met her once. We'd seen each other play. It was very brief. Then I think it must have been like a year later, I got an email from her saying, Charlene, like, I don't really know if you have time for this, but would you be interested in meeting my friend Ellis? And they might be looking for a new lead singer. And I was like, oh, sure. Why not? I'll just go. I was sort of in the mode of like, I'll just try anything. And so I went and met up with Ellis and Alan. We hit it off, sang a couple songs. And it's been over 2 years now.
Wow. What did they
have on the road nonstop?
So cool. What had they had out at that point? So like they had the first album was out.
Their first album was out. So I finished touring with them on their first album and then we recorded the second album and we're still touring on that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So was that sort of like a, okay, this is now, like, did it feel instant, like a sort of finding that direction? You're like, okay, now I don't have to worry so much about, you know, being creative in a way that's like not feeling natural or mm-hmm, coming mm-hmm. easily to me. Like, mm-hmm. this is great. Like, what was your feeling about being part of a 8-piece band, touring
mm-hmm.
band?
Okay. Mm-hmm. It certainly was an experience that I had not anticipated and I'm still surprised by every day. And when I first joined, the prospect of singing somebody else's words and telling somebody else's story was a little conflicting to me because it wasn't something that I ever wanted to seek out necessarily, but now that it was in front of me and I was in this weird place, I was like, I'm just going to try it. I'm just going to see what happens and like how I emotionally resonate with these songs. And fortunately, I really love the music, and Ellis and I have a lot of influences in common. We both love Sufjan Stevens, mm-hmm. and I've always loved Rufus Wainwright and that sort of grandiose approach to arrangement and songwriting. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me with San Fermín. And so, and it was exciting to be a part of this big collective where essentially everybody is a front person at right. some point in the show. We have a barry sax player who basically shreds like he's playing electric guitar. We have a trumpet player that goes out into the crowd almost every show and basically is hanging from something at the end of the show. Alan is the other lead singer in the band. And our violinist also goes out there and just rips. And it's so much fun. I love sharing the stage with them and seeing how the audience reacts to that sort of weird like mixing board of like, people is really, really cool.
There is a perception about the band that it is less about these individuals than it's almost like a theater company. And there's a greater story being told mm-hmm. over the course of the album. So it's less about like who's singing this song mm-hmm. or that song than mm-hmm. like this is a greater work that you all are just smaller pieces of, which I think makes it really stand out from mm-hmm. other bands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was probably easier then for you to step in.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that for sure.
Right.
Vocally it's a very challenging collection of music mm-hmm. that Ellis writes. So were you ever intimidated by that, or was that like, fuck yeah, bring on the bring it on?
I was so intimidated. When I was first auditioning and learning the songs, I could not imagine singing half of the stuff that I had heard on the record because it was so high and so expansive. And I just don't write like that for myself. And mm-hmm. I think that's changed how I've written for myself since. But the Lucius girls actually sing on the first record, and they're phenomenal singers. And to think of singing Sunsick with their, which is the song that really got
did
them
he
a lot
write
of
that with them in mind, or he found them? How did that?
I think he wrote it before they came on board, but he could probably correct me if that's wrong. But yeah, I was not in like a great place of confidence, and I didn't feel like my voice was capable of doing all this crazy,
acrobatics.
Yeah, nonsense. And so,
yeah, I mean, it couldn't be like you have to replicate Sunsick like they did it. It's got to be a reinvention.
Sure,
right?
Sure. And it took me a while before it didn't feel like I was singing live band karaoke.
Yeah, yeah.
To San Fermín band.
Right,
know?
Yeah.
And so I think when the second record came out, then I really felt like I had an ownership and an identity with those songs and mm-hmm. being a part of this project. And I started to feel like that towards the end of the first album cycle, but it was still like I was trying to find my place and trying to fend off comments like, where did the other girl go?
Oh man. Like that. Yeah. That's sorry. Yeah. So you came in and they had already, were the eight or seven others, had they been all together and you were sort of the one new?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's intense.
Yeah.
You're like the Aunt Viv of...
Yeah.
Yeah. But more beloved. Fresh Prince.
Okay. Because they changed actors?
Yeah.
Okay, weird.
Yeah, sorry, that was a backer. Yes,
that's great.
Different actors came in to play Aunt Viv.
No, but I do remember that. It's strange.
Nobody worry about it. It's fine.
Yeah. They used to do that back then in TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, starting with like Bewitched. I think now they finally like, okay, you guys get it.
Yeah.
You're on to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just anyway. And switch.
Yeah.
So now this is your second year touring with them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're about to go back on the road?
Yeah, we are touring like pretty steadily all summer. We just got back from a 3-week tour, and now we're off for the next 10 days. Then we're going out again for a week, and then we're playing like a festival in Latvia in July.
Fun.
Yeah, it's doing like things cool. We've never done. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're working on your own stuff still in the meantime, or
yeah, I've just finished some new stuff that I think I'm going to try to release in the next few months, which is really exciting for me.
Release it
it's
how?
Been a long time. Just release it.
Digitally?
Put it out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
I think so.
Yeah, that's the cool thing. I feel like you have been able to have different things happening in your career without there needing to be like bigger forces at play necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Like, like your first two albums you were able to put out on your own, and you have a really lovely fan base that's behind you and supporting. And like, how do you account for that having happened? Like, when did you become a figure that people like were following and wanted to have more work from you? Was that from the Star Kid stuff?
I think the Star Kid tour had a lot to do with it, because I was touring with them. I had a three-week tour with them at first, and then like a 4 to 5 week tour with them after that. And then, yeah, I think that was just such an incredible outlet to, and such an incredible gift to perform to their audience every night. And because they're so internet based, they just naturally like adopt whatever they just share whatever inspires them and pass on to their friends. And I think it was really just a miracle of the internet and seeing how
right time, right place, right spread talent, right projects.
Like, but then do you work hard to keep that up? Like, are you big on your webpage? And,
you know, I try to be as engaged as possible, but I haven't had anything going on with my own music since those tours, really. Like, my last album came out in 2012. And I can say now that I think being in San Fermín and having to have stepped back to really do that work, like, I feel completely excited and ready now to release new songs of mine that I've worked on, and that I feel that is truly an accurate reflection of like what I want to say and who I am at in this moment.
That's awesome.
So
do you write on tour? Are you inspired at any moment? It could be totally random, or have you found that like being on the road is sort of what gets you going, or like what is there a pattern to it, or is it?
Yeah, I really like writing on tour, actually. And I think a big part of writing on tour, what's made me do that, is because we sit in a van for up to 10 hours a day sometimes. It can be anywhere from an hour to 10 hours or to sometimes, I want to say like there is actually an unlimited amount of time that one can spend in a van.
And it's 8 of you, or is there,
there are nine
with a, like a tour manager?
No, we have a front of house, and we have a lighting designer sometimes. So when the lighting designer comes, there are 10 people.
And what are you
in
one van? Passenger van or something? A Sprinter.
Yeah. How about you guys? Because we're six in your van.
Yeah,
too.
So we're just six, and we do just like a 15 passenger van, and
so
we drive it ourselves.
You don't have a front of house or anything? Mm-mm. I mean,
we have on occasion, but generally no. I mean, it would be great.
It would be
fantastic, but
six feels so
six,
small.
I know. Most people are like, whoa, you guys are such a big band. Yeah, but like for you guys,
I just remember when you and I went on to someone's proper tour band that we interviewed, and we got off and I was like, that was kind of shitty, that van. And you were like, what? That was so nice.
It was
nice.
Like a palace.
No, honestly, we went on tour with Alt J in the fall.
Okay.
And just looking at their tour bus, I mean, I was on a tour bus with Star Kid, but you really reappreciate what you don't have
Star Kid had a tour bus?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where does that's like a lot of money.
Yeah, how but they were making that? They was definitely justified.
How? I just can't wrap my brain around like internet and money and how things work. Like,
yeah, well,
right. For teenage girls who have no disposable income.
Right. Like, I mean, if it was like
their parents.
Merch,
yeah,
I mean,
their parents.
If they're selling t-shirts at a high enough rate, or at a, you know, enough t-shirts that
Starkid had to bring like three merch people on tour.
Jeez.
With three separate kiosks.
The internet.
People were, and they sold out of stuff every single night. It was crazy.
And so like their productions now they're not still doing that. Like, they didn't say this works. Like, let's not stop doing that.
I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah.
I
okay.
I don't really know.
Yeah. Interesting. But anyway, so you're in the Sprinter with the 8 to 10 people, and you are able to seclude yourself enough in your brain and like have enough peace where you can be creative. That must be fantastic.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. I feel like it's because I'm in a van and I want to feel like I'm being productive.
Right, so that's the challenge.
With our in-ears, you can just put them in and it just blocks out all sound. And so I'm so happy to just sit there and like fiddle with Logic and make beats and try to create stuff.
Yeah. Cool. It's so funny now being in the van. I don't know how new this is, but like, what is it? Hotspots that like give you the internet.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
It's just like, that's a different world. And so now like people are in the van and everyone's like on their laptop, like on the internet. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
And great.
Yeah. Great and sad.
Great, you know.
It's productive.
Right.
Yeah.
But you all get along for the most part, obviously.
We do.
You're gonna tell me. But cool.
All right. So you guys are going to perform something for us?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you playing?
We're going to play a song called Philosopher from our album Jackrabbit, which is the most recent Sam Fermin album.
Cool. Is there any story behind Philosopher?
I might defer to Ellis.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, maybe we should ask Ellis.
Yeah.
Is Ellis in there?
Ooh, we could get Ellis in
there. Can Ellis run over and tell us about this song?
Hey.
Hi.
So great to speak with you.
Yeah.
So you're going to play Philosopher?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. So is there a story behind this, the writing of this and or the song of it?
Yeah, I think I was, when I was writing this song, I was living in New Hampshire for a couple weeks. And I was thinking about a lot of the people that I know from New York and sort of the trying to be too cool for everything. And how like in doing that, you sort of maybe miss some of the emotional realist, you know, realism of being a person. So I think this song is sort of about trying to be, relying on your philosophy to get you through things that are actually not manageable in that way.
Very cool. Sort of being yourself and sticking to your own mind. Yeah. All right, cool. Let's do it.
Cool.
When I grow up, I think that I could be an actress. I let the camera find the truth in these little eyes. And I could feel what it was like to be electric and let the people hear me scream and shout with this little mouth. And if I let all my demons out, how you would love it. And I would let the makeup run all down my face. I'm a philosopher, I try to put it all behind me. I'm a philosopher, I gotta try to keep it down. I'm a philosopher, no, I'll never let it find me. I'm a philosopher, gotta control it somehow. And when they're finished with me, I could be your lover. And you could try to find the blush of youth in these cheeks. Try to forget what it was like to be electric and to wink at all the boys at home with these eyes. I'm a philosopher. This is over, I'll be looking for a way to let it go. I'm getting